Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The Supreme Court of the United States is in the headlines for many reasons. First, early on Wednesday morning, President Trump said that he would go to the court to do exactly what? Who knows? Remember, even before Election Day, the court had issued decisions affecting the process of counting ballots in Pennsylvania and North Carolina, and both states have yet to be called. Now, secondly, in the midst of all this election news, the court has work of its own to do. It's hearing cases this week, including with new Associate Justice Amy Coney Barrett. And the cases are interesting. There's a voting rights case, LGBTQ rights case, another dealing with juveniles receiving life sentences, as well as the one we've heard about, the Affordable Care Act. WNYC's legal editor and senior editor for the Race and Justice Unit, Jamie Floyd, joins us. Jamie, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Allison.
So Wednesday morning, during a speech where President Trump falsely claimed victory, he also told his supporters, quote, "This is a major fraud in our nation. We want the law to be used in a proper manner. So we'll be going to the Supreme Court. We want all voting to stop." So when he's saying we'll be going to the Supreme Court, going with what?
Yes, exactly right, Allison. Going with what? You have to go with facts, and you have to go with the law, and you have to go at the right time, not too early, right, and not too late. And first, I guess it's important to take a step back and take a deep breath. Thank you for the meditation. I actually needed it, so I appreciate it each and every day. It's important to know how the process is supposed to work. That's the first thing we need to take a step back and recognize in this moment of uncertainty. Because, Allison, in a normal election, we would all sit around and watch CNN or listen to Brian Lehrer, and we would pretty much know the result by 9 or 10 o'clock on election night, or certainly by the next morning when you turn on your phone, or if you're old school, you go to your doorstep for that newspaper, if you still get one, and there's the result, right? But due to this pandemic and therefore this unprecedented surge of mail-in voting, absentee balloting, it's taking longer to count than it has in the past, and that's fine. That leaves us with a lot of counting to do, and it leaves us with this uncertainty about the outcome. Right now, Biden, as I last checked, was at 264 of 270 electoral votes, Trump at 214. So Trump would need to win Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Nevada, and Georgia, or Allison, getting to your point, be successful in one of the legal challenges to win the White House. And those legal challenges is where he seems to be turning his attention. You know, those major swing states where you would bring your lawsuit, potentially decisive Pennsylvania, not having been called yet. And do we start to hone in on recounts and legal challenges? President Trump started tweeting, as you said, on election night, early into Wednesday morning, asking the Supreme Court to intervene. Quote, "We'll be going to the U.S. Supreme Court." So as you say, Allison, he's right about one thing. The courts make decisions when there is something to decide, but he's not right about the process when he says we want all voting to stop. That is not how the process works.
Yesterday, the campaign filed suits to halt the counting of ballots in Michigan and Pennsylvania, demanding increased access to the process. This morning, a judge in Pennsylvania did grant increased access to the ballot count. So what is next?
Right. So let's take Pennsylvania first, because he's filed suit in several states, but Pennsylvania is where everyone seems to be looking. The team filing, Trump's team filing suit there to stop the counting, citing the timing. In other states, Allison, he wants them to keep counting. So he's got these inconsistent theories. But in Pennsylvania, he's citing the timing for the counting of mail-in ballots. In other words, counting ballots that came in after Election Day, as long as they were postmarked by Election Day. That's the law in Pennsylvania. He's challenging that. And he's also challenging the process by which the counting is occurring. Now, every state has a different set of rules in place for when they count and how they count. the ballots that are voted in person as well as the ones that are absentee. That's every year. This year is really no different. What is different is COVID, which makes that volume of absentee ballots much higher. And Allison, we've been on this bronco before in Pennsylvania. My grandmother used to use that expression. The Trump campaign sued Pennsylvania three times over its COVID-19 plans in just the last few weeks, and they've lost three times. They lost in state court, they lost in federal court, and they essentially lost in the Supreme Court. As of this hour, President Trump is actually ahead in Pennsylvania, but because his margin is shrinking as more mail-in ballots are counted, he's asking once again to stop the counting. He's suing to stop the counting, but the counting continues. Observers are observing the counting, but seeing that the lead is shrinking, Rudy Giuliani and his team, which for some reason includes Eric Trump, has parachuted in to claim that the manner of observation is unfair. But the law in Pennsylvania, Allison, I think is pretty clear about where observers can stand and how challenges can be made and who gets to make them. But Allison, the Supreme Court in its Pennsylvania case a week ago left the door open for renewed challenges. So when you say, what's next? Just today, the federal election judge in Pennsylvania said, look, I don't see anything wrong with the process here. The counting can go on. What's next? Donald Trump can appeal.
Before we leave the topic of the Supreme Court, I do want to point out that Sandra Day O'Connor, in her retirement, she was on the Supreme Court in 2000 that decided Bush v. Gore. And she said of that case, quote, it gave the court a less than perfect reputation. What was the impact of the court's involvement to its, to, you know, what did it do to the institution? And is that specter of 2000 going to haunt this court?
Well, I covered Bush versus Gore. I was there. And I also knew Justice O'Connor personally, but I never got to ask her about this because by that time I was a journalist. So I walled myself off from the justices and I never got to interview her specifically about Bush v. Gore. But I'm going to tell you, Allison, the day that decision came down, having been a lawyer and having this great love and respect for the law and the court, I'm going to say, and I know my mother's listening, I lost my intellectual virginity that day. I was such a believer, Allison, in our courts and our system and the law as, our trilateral system of democracy and the Supreme Court as the ultimate stopgap. I really believe that despite their political leanings, the court of this land, the justices would do the right thing, and they did not. They did the political thing with Bush versus Gore. And Justice Scalia, who was so brilliant a writer, wrote a shoddy opinion. Allison, it's a poorly written decision. Read it. Anyone can read it and see how poorly written it is. And I say that with all due respect. And later he said, quote, we had to do something in Bush versus Gore because countries were laughing at us. France was laughing at us. Well, Allison, that's not a reason to decide an election, to inject yourself in a political process. As for the second part of your question, the ghost of Bush versus Gore, yes, I think Chief Justice Roberts is aware of it. He's an institutionalist, and he cares about the reputation of the court. He remembers that moment. And, you know, Justice O'Connor said in 2012, quote, we took the case and decided it. It was still a big election issue. Maybe the court should have said, we're not going to take it. Goodbye. And I imagine they will be thinking about that as Trump versus Biden makes its way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
My guest is Jamie Floyd, WNYC's legal editor and senior editor for WNYC's Race and Justice Unit. This dovetails nicely into one of the cases the court's hearing, voting rights. There were two cases. They have been put together. They look at provisions of a voting rights law in Arizona that the federal appeals court had ruled could be discriminatory. What will the justices be looking at?
All right. So before they did anything else this term, Allison, before they even took to the bench on the first Monday of October, they granted cert in a voting rights dispute over what some Republican operatives call ballot harvesting. And Allison, I think what we need to understand, you and I have talked about this, whenever we talk about voting rights, it's this. Democrats benefit when more people vote. Republicans do not. That's really the bottom line. And so what the Republican strategists who filed this brief call ballot harvesting It's really just a law that allows third parties to collect and deliver ballots in some states, including Arizona. This is a commonplace practice used by Arizona and a dozen or so other states to get out the vote. And that's all it is. And they want to continue to do this in Arizona. And the Republicans who filed suit in this state do not. And that's what the U.S. Supreme Court is considering.
Let's look at the Affordable Care Act case, Texas versus California. They'll hear argument. It's the latest challenge, we have to say, to the Affordable Care Act. And this is also, this challenge is one we've seen before because it's around the individual mandate.
Right.
What's different this time?
All right. The first question, we'll do it quickly. The first question is whether the red states or two individual consumers have legal standing to challenge the law at all. They could throw it out on that. The second question, if they get past that, is whether Congress, back in 2017, rendered the law's individual insurance mandate unconstitutional by eliminating the tax penalty that was attached to the mandate to the law. And then finally, if the court finds that mandate unconstitutional, is the mandate so intertwined with the rest of the law, the ACA's other provisions, that the whole thing falls? So those are the three questions before the court.
Now, the court has heard seven cases challenging the ACA over the last 8 years.
Right.
How strong is this particular challenge?
I don't think it's particularly strong, and most analysts do not. In fact, many were surprised that the court took the case at all.
The Fourth Amendment case, Jones versus Mississippi. You know, this is the one that I'm very interested in. On Election Day, the justice heard these arguments. Jones versus Mississippi, a case that questions whether the Eighth Amendment, which prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, requires that judges assess a juvenile defendant as, quote, incorrigible before sentencing them to life without parole. What are the judges assessing when they measure incorrigibility?
Right. Now, we could do a whole hour on this topic alone. You know, Justice Kennedy spent 15 years putting pretty strict limits on harsh penalties for crimes committed by juveniles. He really believed that until you reach the age of at least 18 or 21, your brain had not fully formed, and it was unfair for our society to mete out the kinds of punishments we mete out for adults to juveniles. And the biggest case was about death penalty for juveniles. But now Justice Kennedy is gone. The question before the court in this case, as you say, is about life without the possibility for parole. And it involves Brett Jones, who had only turned 15 in 2004 when he and his girlfriend were discovered by his grandfather in their room. The two men fought and argued, and the youth stabbed his grandfather 8 times, killing him. So a horrible crime. The question is not whether he should be set free. The question is whether he served enough of his time, whether life without any possibility of parole is fair for a juvenile, or whether a juvenile can be rehabilitated. When you ask the question about incorrigibility, well, Allison, that is the question that they grappled with, the justices grappled with during the oral arguments. Not just Justice Sotomayor, as we would expect. She asked a lot of questions about this. She expressed qualms about requiring justices to use what she called magic words regarding the mental state of juvenile offenders. But also John Roberts made a similar point, asking a lot of questions about what would make or would not make a young person, quote unquote, incorrigible. So this is a very, very hard case for the justices. I think they want to find a path for rethinking LWAP, as we know it in the law, for young people. But it's a difficult one, more about psychology and psychiatry than about law and legal limits.
My guest is Jamie Floyd, WNYC's legal editor and senior editor of WNYC's Race and Justice Unit. Let's talk about Fulton versus the City of Philadelphia. While we were all focused on election returns, the justices heard arguments in this case. What's at issue in this case?
Well, this is a really challenging and difficult case, especially, you know, it's a classic U.S. of A kind of case. You have religious issues, freedom of religion issues. You have gay and lesbian LGBTQ couples who want to provide homes for foster children. You have Catholic social services in the city of Philadelphia trying to do the right thing. There really are no bad actors here. It's about the city of Philadelphia contracting with private foster care agencies, and part of that contract, Catholic social services. But along the way, it was revealed by the Philadelphia Inquirer, another good actor here, a journalism organization, disclosed that CSS did not certify and place children in the homes of same-sex couples. So then the city stopped paying CSS for placing more children in private homes. And I like to talk about Supreme Court cases, Allison, in terms of the actual petitioners involved rather than the big lofty legal issues and, mm-hmm. and cases. The two individual foster parents here are just lovely petitioners who have been doing right by children in the city of Philadelphia for years. Many, many children have gone through their homes. One of the two petitioners adopted two children, ages 3 and 5, and they really want to do the right thing. So the question here is, can a foster parent be excluded from consideration? Is CSS being targeted by the city? Is this kind of decision-making by the city constitutionally permissible? And it's really an interesting case because, of course, Amy Coney Barrett mm-hmm. is now on the court, and the precedent in the case is one of Justice Scalia's major cases.
And explain, if you wouldn't mind, going a little deeper into why Amy Coney Barrett is of particular interest when it comes to this particular case.
Well, of course, she's a devout Catholic, which is not supposed to enter into her scholarship or her jurisprudence, but we are aware of it. And critics of Justice Barrett have pointed to previous statements that she's made and letters that she signed about LGBTQ rights, and they've expressed concern that her personal views will cloud her views as a justice. Now, she's refuted that at her confirmation hearings, and of course, she herself is an adoptive parent, which would cut in the other direction. But people will closely be watching to see which way she votes on this case.
Jamie, I had to tell you something funny. In our Slack channel, it's like, Jamie on fire. Fire emoji, 100% fire emoji. So my question for you is,
I love talking about this stuff, Allison, and I love talking about it with you.
My question for you is, as you're watching the returns, and this is a little unfair because I didn't tell you I was going to ask you this, and you can just tell me to buzz off, but what are you on fire about as you watch what's happening with the election and the results?
Well, you know, I at the risk of sounding, you know, corny, I hate that word, but it is, I'm on fire about democracy. Mm-hmm. I mean, all these people standing online 4 and 5 and 6 hours to vote. All right, come on now. The turnout is, I mean, we don't know exactly what it has been yet, but both in-person and absentee voter turnout is beyond what it was in 2016 and 18. And to me, that is a positive. I mean, I know people are feeling uncertain. Some people are feeling depressed. I'm not feeling depressed. I'm feeling excited. I'm feeling engaged. I'm feeling inspired. And if the last 4 years, you know, has a silver lining, all of the protest, this horrible, horrible ongoing pandemic, the discord, the dissension, you know, I hope we can come together as a nation. I believe we can. But if there is a silver lining that has the words voter participation attached mm-hmm. to it, and voter engagement and voter registration, well, Allison, I feel hopeful. And so that is what I'm feeling as I watch the returns come in. And I do believe we have to wait. Patience mm-hmm. is part of the process.
As Alicia Keys says, this girl is on fire. Jamie Floyd, WNYC's legal editor. Janie, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me, as always.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.